Well, good morning. I'm not Ted Maxwell. This is Matt Neely. I'm sitting in for Ted Maxwell this morning on 10:30 The Voice, the morning voice. Thanks for joining us. We've got an action-packed show for you today. First off, we're going to be speaking with Angel Charity in a few minutes, Angel Charity for Children, about their spring event. At 7:30, we're going to be speaking with Cochise County... wow, tongue-tied. Cochise County Supervisor, Frank Antonori. And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to be speaking with podcaster Bill Bupert. And he's got a fascinating take on the administration's plans to possibly fight the Mexican drug and human trafficking cartels in Mexico. And he dedicated two of his podcasts to that. And we're going to be talking to him at 8 o'clock. And like to welcome Greg Gehringer to the show. Greg's my boss, the operations manager and program director here at 10:30 The Voice, and it's an honor to have you sitting in with us and be able to talk with you.
It's always fun actually being on this side of the glass. I mean, it reminds me of how much you have to do every day. This is actually a lot harder. Except for last weekend when I had to come in and reprogram all the satellites.
That is a Herculean effort.
And a major, major, major headache. Looking forward to the thing about the cartels, because you and I actually were talking about that yesterday in my office, or in our office, I guess you could say.
Absolutely.
That's going to be fun. It's Big 12 tournament starting today.
Yeah.
Of course, Arizona won't face anybody until Thursday.
So... in their bracket, Utah and University of Central Florida face off today. You said it was the late game, right?
That's the late game. The early game, everything gets underway at 9:30. Cincinnati taking on Oklahoma State, Colorado and TCU, and then the Scum Devils will be taking on Kansas State at 4 o'clock. All of that happening in Kansas City. And I have ESPN Plus. I know you do not, own Tom Fairbanks doesn't either. But
if we step back a minute, the whole reason that they wanted to move to another conference was for more visibility. And so now they moved from the Pac-12 network, which did not have coverage on DirecTV, to the Big 12 network, where they're going to televise their tournament basketball games on a pay-per-view format.
Well, the Pac-12 network, you know, did have its headaches. They had a period of time there where they could never work out a deal with DirecTV, I know. But for the most part, can you remember a time on the Pac-12 network that if a game wasn't being carried nationally on ESPN or somewhere else, that you couldn't find the game?
No, I do not remember that. I do not remember a time. So this is a German word that I always like to use. It's Schlimmbesserung. It's an improvement that makes things worse.
I don't know that one. Yeah. How do I not know that one?
Schlimmbesserung. Look it up.
Schlimmbesserung.
UNG. Schlimmbesserung. Yes.
You know what? And I'm even... Gehringer's even German. It's, and I can't do that.
It's an improvement that makes things worse, Greg. So that's the way to look at it. And we had some big news here on 10:30 The Voice last night. We debuted a new show called The Rush Hour with James Golden, known to many as Bo Snerdly. He was Rush Limbaugh's longtime producer.
I was really looking forward to this being on the air. It kind of fell in our lap. I knew that he had done this show, but one of the things about radio is we use satellite receivers. There's some broadband delivery of programs, but for the most part, we still use satellite receivers to get our programs. So he finally went onto one of the satellite receivers we had.
Excellent.
As opposed to like having to install yet another one. So that all came together. The timing was perfect, especially for the time change, which occurred, you know, on Sunday. And that meant that Mark Levin had to move 3 to 6. One of the demands of the Great One is that his show always be live. So we had that 6 p.m. slot open up, and one of the first things he talked about was a story I hadn't heard yesterday, and that was about the rally in Wisconsin, I guess, for Bernie Sanders. Yeah. Thinking of the Detroit Lions Hall of Fame running back.
You know, he's making a comeback. So,
but yeah, look up that story about the trans musician that was singing one of the most offensive songs that I've ever heard in my life. Cannot play that song on the radio.
It was that good, huh?
It was that good. Yeah. I mean, seriously,
it's like
you've got
the old adage: don't tell a joke that's so good that HR wants to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah, Google that story.
Yeah.
And then also on the way in, I mentioned to you, I've become a real big fan of Chris Tagal over the last two or three months.
He's on 10:30 The Voice. He's our replacement for Hugh Hewitt, who moved to afternoon. So he's on from 4 to 7 every morning live.
That's right. So he was talking this morning on my way in. I was hearing him talk about, he played a clip of Van Jones, who was basically explaining his take on why he thought the Democrats lost. And he was being very honest. He basically was saying, when you try to defend the status quo and then you call everyone in America names that aren't justified, what's that going to get you?
Well, certainly, yeah. If you characterize half of the country, half of the nation as whatever, racist or xenophobes or whatever we're going to go to, yeah.
That led to him talking about Whoopi on The View complaining about the fact that Gavin Newsom has now come out and said that, you know, he doesn't support male athletes competing against women if those male athletes claim that they're trans.
Right.
So he, you know, she took offense to that. And on the show with her was Dylan Mulvaney, who's the individual, if you remember, in the Bud Light commercials that led to that
took down Anheuser-Busch in a 2-minute video, yeah.
But then you and I were talking that it's only natural, you know, we're several years away, but it appears Gavin Newsom, through his podcast, is now desperately trying to shift to the center to be that moderate.
Sure. Yeah, so that's what he has to do, right? I mean, they've all realized that maybe they misjudged the sentiment of the public. So you've got people now that want to run later that know they have to kind of rebrand themselves a bit.
But I think he is definitely going to be a player in the game. And the question will be if those centrists in this country want to buy what he's selling.
Mm-hmm.
That what, he's had an epiphany? He's come around? He's not who he was when he was the mayor of San Francisco? And I think I've always thought there was something disingenuous about Gavin Newsom. I mean, that's maybe the nature of a lot of politicians, but to me, he tried to be whoever he thought he needed to be at that moment.
Yeah.
As opposed to being ideologically pure.
Well, I tell you what, as governor of California, I think his hands are full with managing California. They've got a few things to deal with, most notably cleaning up after a huge, huge, devastating wildfire. So hopefully, and figuring out how to get their high-speed rail to run, if that'll ever happen. So hopefully they will, he will stick with the task at hand and get that done.
Somehow the idea of a bullet train from L.A. to Las Vegas with the infrastructure problems we have in this country just seems like...
It didn't even work as a TV series on NBC in the 70s. So,
Super Train!
You know, Super Train.
Oh, my God, I love Super Train.
Oh, you were the one.
No, I did. I absolutely love Super Train.
And again, you mentioned it in the news. Today is Election Day. It's the Proposition 414, that's the one item on the ballot, and Tucsonans are voting. And if you haven't turned in your mail-in ballot, take it with you to one of the community centers that Greg read in the opening thing, and we can do a recap of those later.
You and I haven't talked about this. Have you seen any kind of polling on this thing?
None. But I've seen a lot of signs and a lot of, they have people enlisted on both sides, trying to get the word out, get their view out. So you do have a yes on 414 and a no on 414 movement, and they have been taking out some ads, writing letters to the editor, putting things on social media. So there is plenty of chatter, and some of the stories I've read, I think between the two groups, they've raised around $300,000, and of course that doesn't count any last minute donations that have come in. So there, it has forced lots of spending, and I know I'm sure both sides are out chasing ballots right now, calling people who haven't, who it doesn't show that they've sent in their ballot, and they're out chasing ballots and getting them to drop them off.
And I think what I'm also curious about, if you look back to the, the primary, the beginning of August.
Yeah.
Okay. You had a turnout of like 21 or 22% in that election, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And so I'm really curious about this, because if it follows the model that many of these follow, these special elections, these kind of, you know, not regularly scheduled primaries, yep, when you have that low turnout, you're talking about a huge performance by the far, far left. as what happened, you know, that was it. It was like most of the votes were cast by people that were obviously on the far left edge of the party.
I've said this numerous times. Their get out the vote effort on the left is amazing. I mean, and look at how the deck is stacked on the city mayor and council in the city of Tucson, and look at every other tax proposition that has gone through, the raises for the city council, all that stuff. So their get out the vote effort is, I mean, you just have to applaud them on that. I mean, it doesn't bode well for the direction that I would like things to go, but hopefully the Republicans and the No on 414 crowd have worked the get out the vote.
Well, I mean, I hope so, but if you haven't decided by now, then I just believe you're completely out of touch.
Right.
I mean, if you are one of those people that believe that the Grijalva cabal has done a great job for the city, then okay, I get it. Just like those that voted overwhelmingly to keep Laura Conover in power.
Right.
But how can you give more money to a city that can't manage the money they have?
That's right. And I think that's the big argument from the no crowd. It's like, look, of course, we're pro-law enforcement, we're pro-public safety, but maybe prioritize that in your budget process. I think that's the take-home message from the No on 414 crowd. All right, it is 7:14. You're listening to The Morning Voice. Matt Neely sitting in for Ted Maxwell. We're going to be coming right back with Angel Charity for Children talking about their spring event. Well played, Greg. Calling all angels. I'm Matt Neely on The Morning Voice, and we have, I feel like I should say, my name is Charlie. Good morning, angels.
Good morning.
So we have Vicki Curtis, the Angel Charity General Chair for the year, Betty Jo Weaver, the Vice Chair, and Brittany Smith, the Chair for the Spring Event. And thank you for joining us. Why don't you real briefly tell us about Angel Charity?
Thank you, Matt. It's amazing to be here with you this morning. We're delighted to talk about Angel Charity for Children, one of our favorite things in Tucson. Angel Charity for Children is a nonprofit organization comprised of 250 devoted volunteers. We represent a cross-section of the Tucson community. And this year, we're celebrating 43 years of helping children in the community. Angels are committed to providing Pima County's children with the vibrant future they so richly deserve through our annual grant process. Every year since 1983, thoroughly researched, tax-exempt children's agencies benefit from our year-round fundraising programs. And this year, we are so excited to announce that we will be granting a record-breaking $1.75 million towards eight agencies in Pima County.
Holy smokes. Well, who are your beneficiaries this year?
Well, Matt, that's really exciting news. For 2025, we have two impact grant beneficiaries, Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Southern Arizona. They're slated to receive just over $856,000, and we're going to renovate a building for them. Really, really excited about that. It's going to be a mentoring activity center. So at-risk youth in the community can use that, and the Big Brothers and Big Sisters can have activities there. We're so excited to do that. Also, San Miguel High School, and we'll be funding $568,000 to give them a fleet of vehicles for their work-study program. Without those vehicles, they really cannot have that program, and that high school is in great need and wonderful kids and along with that, eight other opportunity grants. Too many to mention.
Yeah, they take the kids in those vans and they take them to internships around the city, around the region, where they can learn skills that'll translate to their professional lives.
Exactly.
Incredible program.
So, in order to fund these very worthwhile charities and organizations, I see you have Angel Heart Pajama Project, the Arizona Friends of Foster Children Foundation, Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, Hope Kids, Literacy Connects, and Spreading Threads Clothing Bank. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
And so in order to do that, you've got to raise a lot of money. And I know you've got a few events every year. And today we're going to be talking about the first of those events. the spring event. Go ahead, Brittany, would you like to jump in on that one?
Yeah, so excited to get to sort of unveil our first event, major event of the year, and that's our Angel Charity Spring event. And so with that, we invite you to join us for an afternoon getaway at Sips and Sunsets, a Mediterranean escape. This year's spring event will be held on Sunday, April 27th at the beautiful Omni Tucson National. Our sponsors and VIPs will have early access to the event and will arrive at 3 p.m. And then at 4 p.m., we will welcome our general admission. You can purchase tickets right now or sponsorships on our website at angelcharity.org. And Sips and Sunsets is not just another evening out. It is the perfect mix of philanthropy and fun. And it is going to be an unforgettable experience for all of our guests. We invite you to come and immerse yourself in the warmth and charm of the Mediterranean right here in Tucson. We will have a fabulous live DJ, DJ Lowkey, who will be setting the mood for the entire evening. You'll enjoy inspired appetizers and premium beverage selections. We'll have wine tastings available as you browse our carefully curated pop-up shops, which will offer both traditional and experiential shopping. This year, we thought it would be fun, too, for the guys who attend this event to have a space to network an event. And so we're creating a lounge area that will feature premium rolled cigars, bourbon tastings. And I'm so excited to share that we have just recently secured a virtual golfing experience as well. So all of that and so much more will make this event so fun. It's something you're not going to want to miss. But I do want to take a chance to bring it back to the big Y for Angel. And every ticket we sell, every sponsorship that is a partnership for us this year, every purchase the day of will support Angel Charity for Children and make a meaningful impact in the children's lives in Pima County. So we really encourage you guys to secure your spot now. This event will absolutely sell out. And again, you can get your tickets or partner with us as a sponsor on our website at angelcharity.org.
Well, and ladies, I would like to just thank you for giving it a dignified name, the gentleman's lounge, instead of like the timeout room, or drop your husband's boyfriends or whatever off while we go and have fun. So, so thank you for giving it a little more of a dignified name. And yeah, that's up at Omni National, right?
It is.
Yeah, that is going to be a lot of fun. I've been to one of these type events with Angel Charity, and you guys do it right. There's always good things to eat and plenty of fellowship, and it looks like we're going to have some music with us, some music to enjoy. So yeah, and you know what better of a Mediterranean theme than up at Omni at the resort there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful space, recently renovated, and much of the event will take place on their outdoor terrace. So, I mean, the backdrop couldn't be more perfect with the Tucson Mountains in the background and the beautiful Arizona sunset.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will be there. I have to find some golf clubs. All my golf clubs have 90-degree bends in the shaft. I don't know how that happened, but I will look forward to participating in the virtual golf because you can't put out any windows with virtual golf, so that's good.
Perfect time to get a little instruction.
Right. I need lots of instruction for golf. Well, it sounds like a really fun event. Tell me a little bit more about some of the shopping opportunities, like what kind of outlets, retail or whatever are you going to have there for people to peruse?
Yeah. So our team that is working specifically on vendors, they're working diligently to secure vendors that we have worked with in the past, but also some really new and exciting vendors. And like I said, we're trying to offer shopping experiences that are a little more experiential. And what I mean by that is for you to actually participate in the item that you are purchasing versus just going and picking up and selecting. So we're looking to have a jewelry vendor that does permanent jewelry, which is something that's really new and fun.
Please do tell. This is I'm behind the power curve on this one.
Yeah, no. So instead of just selecting a piece of jewelry that you find beautiful, you can actually make some of this jewelry by adding charms, and they will affix it to you right in that moment. And so it is permanent. You just don't take it off until, well, forever. I mean, you could wear it forever. We're also looking at, and this was a great suggestion by an angel here with us today, that having a perfume vendor that will actually allow you to mix your own custom perfume.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, these are just some of the fun things that we are trying to procure for this year. Of course, we will partner with other companies that we've worked with in the past that are tried and trues and that are favorites of angels. But yeah, we're just trying to sort of come up with new and exciting things that maybe some of our patrons haven't seen before, and also to engage, you know, our new audience.
So how long have the three of you been involved with Angel Charity?
Ooh.
Betty Jo?
1994 for
Is
me.
Is that right?
Yes.
Is that right?
Longer than some of my children have been alive. But it's such a worthwhile organization. We do what we do for the children, near and dear to my heart and many others, and we couldn't do it without all of our partners and donors and local businesses, and we strive to, you know, include them in all of our events, and it gets me emotional.
Well, that's what's so neat about the spring event and the shopping is everything will be local, and it's such a wonderful opportunity for our community to come together on behalf of the 8 organizations we're raising funds for this year. And we'll have at least 20 local vendors who are teaming up with us, and hopefully 300-400 people will be at the event supporting these wonderful organizations.
And when did you get involved with
I'm the baby of the group. This is my second year as a full-fledged angel. I did my Cherubier 3 years, so this is my third year.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, and you got in the same time as Kelly, right?
I did, 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And you talked, Betty Jo, about your kids being younger than your Angel Charity experience. When I joined 9 years ago, my kids were in first grade and preschool, and now I have one in high school and one in eighth grade, so they've definitely grown up through Angel Charity, and it's been so rewarding for them to go around town and see the Angel Charity logo on buildings like the Girl Scouts of Southern Arizona and the old Big Brothers Big Sisters building in downtown and all over the place.
Yeah, and my wife has been an angel same amount of time as you, Vicki, Kelly Terhune Neely. And
we love her.
And you know,
if you're listening, Kelly, hi.
And it goes back
good morning,
to 19
Kelly.
It goes back to 1983. You got a lot of great people doing good things for children in Pima County. Once again, Sips and Sunset, Sunday, April 27th. Starts at 3 o'clock for VIP arrival, 4 o'clock general admission. Omni Tucson National Resort and Spa. And a Mediterranean escape. Can't wait to see you there. Can't wait to see some of our Morning Voice listeners there, too. Thanks for being on with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Matt.
Much success to your event. We'll be right back. We'll be speaking with Cochise County Supervisor Frank Antonori. You're listening to The Morning Voice. Nice. Well played, Greg Gehringer. Thank you for that. Thank you for that instigating introduction. You're listening.
I'm sorry. I should have let you jump in there. Timing issue. General Maxwell did text me that as of Monday, the mail-in turnout for Prop 414 was at 25%. So I wanted to share that real quick.
Oh, okay. Well, that's probably better than the poll turnout would have been. You're listening to The Morning Voice. Thanks to our Angel Charity for Children team who came in just a few minutes ago. You're listening to The Morning Voice. My name's Matt Neely. I'm sitting in for Ted Maxwell. It's The Morning Voice. We have a different host every day of the week. Mondays, you have Lydia Rhonda with Morning Rainmaker. She was just on yesterday speaking with SVP Social Ventures Tucson and Caitlin Schmidt from the Tucson Spotlight. Today is Civic Engagement. Tomorrow, Wednesday, is Grant Kruger. He's going to be talking with Josh Jacobson about the election results, if they have any. They're saying they may not. Thursday, Tom Moulton in Tourism. Friday, Ed Ackerley with Business Success Stories and University of Arizona Wonder Stories. And now, we are joined by an old friend of mine, Frank Antonori. Frank served the state in the state legislature in both the House and the state Senate. He's also currently the Cochise County Supervisor for District 2, I believe. And this was all after he served our nation with distinction in the Special Forces. And he's a Bronze Star recipient. And I was just thinking about this. It was 20 years ago, later this year, when we first met. Good morning, Frank. Frank?
Not sure why we can't hear Frankie's.
It sounds like he should be on.
Yeah. I hear the sound. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, Frank, maybe you want to try to ring us back real quick. I mean, he's up on the board as he should be. I don't know why we're not actually hearing Frank.
I can hear the sound of something transmitting. Well, we're going to give that a try. So, Frank, we're going to get Frank on the line here in just a second. He is the Cochise County Supervisor, one of three, I believe, and there's a lot of issues coming up with coming up in Cochise County. Oh, now we lost him. Okay, I think he's dialing in again, so we're gonna check that out. He's going to give us a call right back. Anyway, Cochise County has a lot of issues facing it. They had a controversial election for a new jail, and that involved a sales tax. And there we go. I think we got you. For you there, Frank?
Yeah, Matt, I'm here finally, man. So I was in the vast world of hold. I was like trying to get on there, but anyways.
Yeah.
Good to be on. Thanks for having me.
Good to be on. I was just thinking about it. I was thinking back. It was a little later this year. It'll be 20 years that we were introduced when you first decided to take a foray into politics. And that started quite a journey for me, just participating in a couple of your campaigns. Thanks for being on.
Oh, yeah.
So it's,
yeah, you managed my successful entrance into both the congressional world of politics and then eventually the legislature, which was the big one there, and that's I appreciate that so much. Wait. Maybe some of the liberals in Tucson may not, but I do. So, anyways,
yeah, it's if you want to get a PhD or at least a master's in political science, just run for office or work closely with somebody who does, and is the school of real world experience is really amazing.
Sure is.
Well,
we both learned a lot.
We sure did.
Sure did.
So tell us a little bit about. I think I'd like to start with the Cochise County Jail issue, because a couple of years ago there was an election. It was a controversial election, a very close result, and some issues from that are still being hashed out in the courts. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the election and what just happened a couple of weeks ago at the state Supreme Court?
Sure. What really, really occurred is, I don't want to blame COVID for everything, but COVID put this country into a weird funk. And everybody started thinking of different ways to do stuff where they try to just literally mail it in. They didn't show up to do what they should have done. And the previous Board of Supervisors, along with at the time the elections director, decided we're going to do an all mail-in ballot, because we don't want to have to set up polling places. We'll save all sorts of money. And in the end, we'll just mail people ballots. And when they did that, they forgot about technically a registered voter, even though voters are, let's say, inactive. They're on the inactive voter list. By law, they are still registered to vote, and they have to be given an opportunity to vote. And the mistake that was made when they did the election plan and the Board of Supervisors, the previous board, signed off on that plan, they did not have a plan to reach out to those inactive voters. Now, if this election had been on a normal November election, it wouldn't have been an issue because they could have had the opportunity by simply walking into a polling place and voting. They would have been given that opportunity to vote. They wouldn't have been denied the ability. Mm-hmm. However, since it was mail-in only, the decision was made, because it also says in the statute that you don't mail ballots to inactive voters during a normal election cycle. Well, this wasn't a normal election cycle. It was an off-cycle special election. It was held in May to have a special election for the jail. So following what they thought was the law, but again, not following what is the spirit of our country and our democracy, which is to make sure people have an opportunity to have their voice heard by voting, they failed to put a plan in place to find a way to get those inactive voters the opportunity to vote. And the court said, both the appellate and the Supreme Court, that had we done this on an election day when the polling place was open, or we had mailed a card, a simple postcard to those voters, which was not done, but telling them, hey, there's a special election coming up, and if you scan this QR code or go on this website, you can request an early ballot, we would have been covered. The county would have been covered. Mm-hmm. But the county didn't do that. They just ignored 10,800 people. And what we saw in this past November election, almost 700 of them actually physically voted, even though they were inactive. They actually showed up on election day and voted in the presidential election. So they do vote. Those people exist. Sure. So the court said, okay, look, you guys disenfranchised, by definition, it was disenfranchisement, 10,800 people. So now we're going to send this case. Well, what happened was we got sued by a gentleman named Dan LaChance and several other Cochise County residents. So LaChance et al. Filed a suit against the Board of Supervisors, and it's gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court of Arizona ruled that the county did, in fact, by not reaching out to, in some way, those 10,800 people, disenfranchise them. So now they've sent it back to the Superior Court and have asked the Superior Court to make a determination on if that disenfranchisement would have had an impact had those people been given the opportunity by either postcard or by having a physical place to vote in person on election day. Would that have changed the outcome of the election? And that's where we sit right now. So it came back to the Cochise County Superior Court. Obviously, there's a conflict of interest there. So the Cochise County Superior Court Chief Justice recused himself, and they have assigned an out-of-county judge from Apache County to come down here to hear the arguments on whether or not that disenfranchisement would have changed the outcome. So if a judge determines that it did, and it may very well have.
It was a close election. The result was very close.
Yeah, it was 740 votes.
Yep.
Yeah. So Mr. LaChance and his attorney and his witnesses will try to make an argument that did indeed, in their opinion, would have changed the outcome of that election. Now, I just to be straight up with all listeners, I've never shied away from this. As you know, Matt, I hate special districts. Mm-hmm. I despise them, whether it's a jail district or whatever. It's a way for responsible governments to become irresponsible by shifting responsibility off of the general fund and using it as an excuse to raise taxes and create another expansion of government. As a Republican, I am fundamentally opposed to that. What I would have done had I been on the board back then, I would have just simply gone out for a construction bond to build a new jail and asked the voters to bond for a new jail, which is what most governments do. But instead, the previous board and the county administrator at the time decided, well, we're going to do a special district. We're going to expand government. We're going to raise taxes and do a special district. And it barely passed. And then the other thing they did was they knew, because they had Chuck Coughlin, as you know, Chuck and I go way back.
Way back.
So Chuck was a consultant for them at the time. And Chuck wisely, politically, you know, because they paid him to give them sage political advice. And Chuck's a smart guy, although I think he's on the wrong side of the issue sometime. But Chuck's a very smart guy, and he's been around a very long time. He said, hey, if you do this in November, it won't pass. It was basically black and white. And then
sure.
Peggy Judd, the previous who I replaced on the board, actually said on the dais, she told everybody, we have to do this in May, because if we don't do this in May, it won't pass. So they deliberately targeted a segment of the voting population, knowing that because people that vote no show up on regular election cycles. So we're going to do this in May, and we're going to target the voters that would likely support this. And that's what happened. So in the process of doing that, they disenfranchised 10,800 people. The county got sued. We basically lost the argument at the Superior Court, at the appellate court, and then at the Superior Court. So we're back in the Superior Court now, and we'll see what the judge says.
Well,
we could have a new election. He could say it wouldn't have made a difference, and we're at the status quo of where we are right now.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And, you know, frankly, what we're doing today in Tucson is no different. Off cycle, special election to kind of slide a tax in on people here in Tucson. The wheel goes round and round, Frank. We're going to take a little break. We're speaking with Frank Antonori, Cochise County Supervisor. You're listening to The Morning Voice. We're going to take a brief break for a couple of messages, and we'll be right back with more on what's going on in Cochise County. Stay with us. Yeah, Greg, you got to watch out for those traffic lights at the diverging Diamond interchanges, don't you, at Colb and I-10.
There have been a bunch of like traffic light outages, it seems like, in the last couple of weeks, or at least I've heard them mentioned.
Maybe they're taking copper out of the darn lights.
That's probably what it is.
We're on the line with, you're listening to The Morning Voice. This is Matt Neely. We're on the line with Coach, I'm so used to saying state senator or state representative, Cochise County Supervisor Frank Antonori. Welcome back, Frank.
Hey, thanks.
So we were talking about the Cochise County jail tax election. So, you know, and it's still up in the air and there's still going to be court hearings. Meanwhile, they've been collecting this tax. Tell us about the jail itself. I mean, when and where will it be built now that they've been collecting money for 2 years?
Yeah, we've been, we got a meeting today, as a matter of fact, with the company that's sort of doing the design study. I've gotten their presentation. I went through it last night. I can say I'm not very happy with it. There's a lot of things in there that I had thought was going to be put into the plan that wasn't put in. And I think they're still being influenced by the previous board and county administrator. I want a jail that's modular. I want it designed for efficiency. And I want it so it's expandable as the population grows. And the design I saw last night didn't quite do that. So we'll have that discussion this afternoon and maybe get them to put more versatility in the jail. Where we're looking at building it, there's several places, in and around Tombstone is one location. There's one closer to Sierra Vista. There's one by the Douglas Airport. And there's one up by Sybil Road off of I-10. And then there's another one where near the old jail or near the county complex in Bisbee. I'm about putting it in the place that the data shows it's the most efficient place, where the drive time for deputies to provide services to inmates, the logistical support for the jail is all dramatically reduced. And I was on the jail district committee 2 years ago, and what I found there was that the county's spending a lot of money to the contractors that support the jail, the food service contractors, the maintenance contractors, because they all come from Sierra Vista or they come from Tucson, and it's just a long drive to get to Bisbee. So having it close to a major road like State Road 90 or State Road 80 or I-10 is something that I would like to see to give it easy access to tractor trailers and of course for the municipalities to bring their innocent till proven guilty suspects to drop them off, and it would be logistically just something better to put it there. So I'm not a fan of keeping it in Bisbee, and I've also made that publicly known. It just doesn't make sense to me. So we'll see. I got two other folks that get to weigh in on that, though. So I'm not the lone vote. There's three of us on the board, so we'll have that discussion and we'll vote on where we're going to put it.
So Frank, and the jail may be one of them, but what do you think are Cochise County's top one or two issues from your perspective right now as you start your term as one of the Cochise County supervisors?
Yeah, it's sadly a no-brainer, Matt. It's water and roads. Yeah. Of course, we have the Attorney General and the Governor coming down here into Cochise County. They just love Cochise County so much that they've declared war on us and they're decided to go after 40% of our economy, which is probably in my district, probably more than half the economy in my district, which is agriculture, by cutting off the access to water for a lot of farmers and ranchers by establishing an AMA and limiting the irrigation and hurting the wine industry in the process. I've got several wineries that are crying to me that they had a growth plan to expand their wine operations out here, and now that's been stopped by this AMA. They can't expand their wineries, and if they can't expand, and if you're not growing, you're dying. So they're really upset that they're not able to increase the ability to grow more grapes. Of course, existing farmers and ranchers, a lot of them have put a lot of effort into saving water on their own because they still have to pay the cost of pumping that water. There's electrical and diesel costs for running those pumps, and they've put some savings in. And I talked to one of the farmers down here, Mr. Curry, Ed Curry, who grows chili peppers and basil and other spices. And he put in a lot of water saving measures. And now he's being punished for that because those that were abusive with regard to their irrigation, they get to maintain that level. And if they put in water saving measures, they can use that savings to go and irrigate other acreage with that the acre feet that they save. So he's already saved thousands of acre feet by putting in new irrigation systems, and he's stuck there now. Now he's being punished for that. So it's just a crummy way to run things, and it's a sledgehammer approach, and it's top down out of Maricopa County, and folks up there don't understand rural agriculture. They don't understand what it's like to live in the rural part of the state. They all think you just turn on the tap and the water comes out. What's the big deal, right? They don't understand that there's a lot more to it. And they didn't put a lot of stock in local input. They just imposed their will on Cochise County, and it's a big mistake. And we're fighting it, and we're trying to protect our farmers and ranchers out here from what is basically Phoenix, mandated water policy. And we're trying to implement with our representatives in the legislature a way to maybe compromise with the governor and the Department of Water Resources to come up with a plan that's actually reasonable. And that we can work with. We all understand we don't have a lot of water, but how that's managed and the proper way to do that was lost with this blanket AMA, and so we're trying to fix that. And of course, roads. When I was out on the campaign trail, if you talk to 10 people, 8 out of 10 of them will tell you to fix the roads, and 2 out of 10 will bring up water or some other issue. But it was overwhelmingly roads. Cochise County's got a small population. So we get a very small portion of the HERF revenue. We also don't generate a lot of revenue through our sales tax. This county mostly survives on property taxes. So we don't have a lot of money to put into roads. But clearly I heard loud and clear that we got to do something about it. So
well, amen.
We're gonna focus on roads.
Amen, Frank. And this gets back to your issue all along. Reduce the size and scope of government. The private market can figure out how to manage resources quite efficiently.
Yep.
Thanks for being on with me.
Damn roads.
Yeah, right. It's easy. So, Frank, thanks for being on. Thanks for all the good work you do, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
All right. Take care, Matt. We'll see you.
All right. You're listening to The Morning Voice on KBOI AM 1030. We'll be right back. Good morning, and welcome to The Morning Voice. As you can already tell, I am not Ted Maxwell. My name's Matt Neely. I'm sitting in for Ted. He's out taking care of some important business today. And so you got me. We had Frank Antonori on in the last hour. He's Cochise County Supervisor. We also visited with Angel Charity. And you got Greg Gerringer behind the glass, keeping me on time and on target, as Ted Maxwell likes to say. So I had to throw that in for Ted. For this segment, we're going to be speaking with a gentleman by the name of Bill Buppert. Bill is the founder and host of Chasing Ghosts, and a regular warfare podcast. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. His Substack is cgpodcast.substack.com. And he is the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute. Bill, good morning, and thanks for being on The Morning Voice with me today.
Yeah. Good morning, Matt, and I am honored to be with you.
Well, you dedicated 2 episodes of your podcast to something that really caught my eye, or ear, as it were, with the podcast. The Trump administration has declared the Mexican drug cartels as terrorist organizations, and among their strategies, they say they're considering taking U.S. military actions against the cartels in Mexico. And, you know, spoiler alert, you think this is not a good course of action. What are some of the reasons you question this course of action, Bill?
So I have a variety of reasons, and I have Chasing Ghosts in a Regular Warfare podcast. I also have another companion podcast where I cover more conventional conflict futurism, which is called War Notes, a conflict podcast. But I have a lot of beefs with the notion of saying that the cartels are terrorist organizations. I'm not in any way acknowledging or praising their behavior. What I'm saying is that when you do this and you make these declarations, it has a very serious effect, a possible blowback effect on America itself. The cartels, and of course there's a dozen of them, if not more, in Mexico proper, which have migrated for the most part from Colombia because of what happened with the drug war from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and what we've seen with the concentration of Mexico proper. I have several reservations. First and foremost, if you make them a terrorist organization, you are declaring war on the Mexican government, because the cartels aren't simply there as guests who are ignored by the Mexican government. Whether that government acknowledges it or not, They are an integral part of the political behavior that takes place south of the border. And there is also this notion of going kinetic, where we have some very talented shooters in the DOD inventory in CAG, the Combined Arms Group, which is formerly known as Delta, or the unit, STS, Special Tactics Squadron 24, an Air Force organization, Marine Special Operations Command, MARSOC, and SEAL Team 6, which is also their Tier 1 unit. The Tier 1 specification means that these, for the most part, are shooters and assaulters who take part in very specialized military activities that are usually either surgical killing or surgical snatching and those kind of things. My problem with this is that I have several. Number one is all of this, when you try to look at the root cause of it, I'm an engineer by trade, there's root causes and proximate causes. One of the root causes for this is the demand signal in the United States.
Right.
Those cartels would not exist if it weren't for that demand signal. If we try to service the supplier and we don't address the demand signal, folks will be queuing up either south of the border or north of the border to fulfill the need that is surgically or kinetically removed. And I have another beef with this. Newton's third law is a stone-cold killer when it comes to these kind of activities, whether they're military, paramilitary, law enforcement. You are going to get a very violent reaction from the cartels if they start getting their heads lopped off and decapitated. So I think if we're, and remember, we're talking about a black market in an underground economy here that probably has very sophisticated and deep logistical warehousing and human trafficking activities into the United States proper, I would say all of North America. And that once you clack this off and start this war, which will be a war against the Mexican government, if we send military forces into Mexico proper to go after the cartels, the blowback in the United States is going to be unlike anything anybody has ever seen from a violence standpoint.
And from your perspective, I mean, your podcast, Chasing Ghosts, and a regular warfare podcast, it is about insurgencies, counterinsurgencies. I mean, this is what you write about, and this is what you look back on in history in terms of government missteps and how things are handled well or poorly, right? I mean, so you know of what you speak in this kind of operation.
It is certainly the case that since the end of World War II, if we wanted to put a mark in the wall, there's been no successful counterinsurgency conducted by the United States or, for the most part, the West, especially in Islamic countries. We have a very sterling track record of stalemate and defeat, sort of like our latest pullout ignominiously from Afghanistan. And we didn't do too well in the Middle Eastern conflicts in this entire 21st century. I suspect we may be biting off more than we can chew, but I also think that if we don't do this in concert with a domestic plan to address the demand signal, the apparent need or desire for all of these illicit products, you can kill or maim all the folks you want south of the border or even within our own country who are members of these criminal cartels that are providing all of this. But when you do that, not only are there probably dozens, if not hundreds of people queued up to take over for whoever got their head lopped off or removed from the scene in this trade, you're going to have people north of the border who are doing the same. And I also have this other reservation. We know, especially, I formerly lived in Tucson, as you know, Matt. I no longer live there, but we're real close to the border. This is home for us, and we are at the frontiers of this conflict. And we know this in our bones, whether we like to acknowledge this or not. If you or I or some other person is a member of the Border Patrol and we're on the border, and maybe we've got financial difficulties or anything, and I am not casting aspersions at the entirety of the organization, but we know that this has happened, and they say, hey, listen, we're going to give you $10,000 to ignore any blue car that comes through between 1400 and 1600 on Tuesday. Please do that. And once you or I hypothetically accept that, they own us. That is not in atomistic circumstance. I suspect there is a single-digit percentage of all law enforcement organizations in the United States that are compromised or on the take. That complicates everything. And also, what I don't want folks to do is underestimate the intelligence apparatus, and of course, the compromised organizations help to gather that intelligence. The intelligence apparatus for the cartels, these illicit cartels that not only specialize in drugs, but human trafficking, is extraordinary. They have to be, because they're businessmen, and they're businessmen who are participating in a market that means they have to be extra cautious and vigilant about not only the market that they serve, but protecting their market from other interlopers, government organizations, law enforcement, things like that. So I never want anybody to underestimate their sophistication, nor do I want anybody to underestimate the savagery that you will see in response to Connecticut against the cartels south of the border.
We're speaking with Bill Buebert. He's the founder and host of the Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare podcast. And we're speaking about the issue of the federal government, the Trump administration, designating drug and human trafficking cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, and raising the possibility of attacking them at their bases in Mexico. Bill, let's talk a little bit about, you kind of alluded to it in your just completed response. Let's talk about the economics of this, both from the risk-reward trade-off for people who engage in this trade. And as you said, you just said that you take off the head of one organization and there's five more small organizations that could pop up. Talk a little bit about the financial reward of the drug trade and why it is such a strong driver to keep this keep the supply coming to people to fill the demand.
So we're talking a bit about something that is hard to measure. One can make approximations because this is the black market. It's an illicit market, so it's not tracked by the Department of Labor or anything sure. like that, because there is a reportable tax income and things like that. But it is estimated to be hundreds of billions of dollars. I think that we can make that estimate and say that's fair. When Prohibition occurred between 1919 and then its closure in 1933, when the 19th Amendment was abolished and Prohibition was no longer the way of law enforcement in the U.S. and alcohol came above board, millions of dollars were made, billions of dollars, maybe if we extrapolated, if we adjusted for inflation. But it also created a criminal underground that remained resilient and very savvy from that point forward. One can say that the mafia and other organizations, whether it's an Italian flavor or an Asian flavor or an Irish flavor, whatever that may be in regions of the United States at the time, those would not have emerged absent Prohibition. They probably would have had to find other ways to do their business because, for instance, we know there aren't nicotine cartels for the most part. We know there aren't alcohol cartels for the most part because these are above ground activities. And when you're striking at hundreds of billions of dollars, you're going to get those business interests' attention in a big way, especially business interests for whom violence is the law of the land for their economic ecology that they operate in and swim around in.
So when you have this kind of economic draw, and you have people motivated to get involved in this, how do you, other than tamping down demand in the U.S., how can the Mexican government help, and how can the U.S. government help the Mexican government without dropping a bomb on a fentanyl factory?
Man, it's such an interesting question, and I can't say that I'm providing all the answers for this. And
sure.
Again, as an engineer, I also know that where problems are ultimately insoluble, maybe it's not a problem in the first place, but just the state of nature you have to exist with. I'm not saying that that's what everybody has to adopt, but it is certainly something that we have to look at in all the options on this menu before us of what to do. But I just have the worst intuition that if we go kinetic militarily against the cartels, and by the way, I'm not saying that hasn't happened before, because I think that it did when it came to Pablo Escobar, uh-huh. for instance. As a matter of fact, with the various armies that cannot be spoken of that were involved in that, that may have been after the Iran failure, the rescue attempt failure in 1979, it may have been the saving grace for some of these elite tier one organizations was that war in Colombia. But in this case, I just have the worst feeling that this is going to go badly, because they're not going to give this up in an easy fashion. I want to add one more thing, and that's this. They're human traffickers. And we all know that there's this term in the Border Patrol or ICE where they call it OTM, which is other than Mexicans.
Yep.
And we've seen the news footage of folks coming across, even known terrorists, admitting on camera of their activities in the Middle East. They're here. So there is also the potential that if this goes kinetic, all of those possible Islamist sleeper cells, which I think is more of a actual than an if, that are here in the United States, may become auxiliary components of the cartels if they react to going kinetic against them in Mexico.
We're speaking with Bill Buppert, host and founder of the Chasing Ghosts podcast. We're going to take a little break. We got a call. Eric, hang on for just a couple minutes for the break. We'll take your call. And we're talking about Bill's looking a couple of chess moves ahead of where the government is with some of the potential policy decisions that the Trump administration has announced with regards to the Mexican cartels with drugs and human trafficking. You're listening to The Morning Voice. We will be right back with Bill Buppert.
And now back to The Morning Voice with Matt Neely sitting in for General Ted Maxwell.
Again, we're talking with Bill Buppert, founder and host of Chasing Ghosts and a Regular Warfare podcast. Welcome back, Bill.
I'm right here.
All right. Bill, we've got a call from Eric. Eric, if we get him online too, I think it is. Eric, thanks for calling in to The Morning Voice with your question for Bill Buppert.
Good morning. I heard you say that, by declaring these cartels terrorist organizations, we would be going to war against the Mexican government. We're not going to be shooting at Mexican military troops, first of all. Second, your other point is that, yes, we have a demand problem for fentanyl, and that your argument was, therefore, we should be addressing that. We've been addressing the demand problem for drugs for decades. But to say that we shouldn't also address the supply issue, that seems to me illogical. You can do both. And certainly, it seems to me, as far as proximate cause, which is what you were referring to, the proximate cause is the supply. The demand is secondary and only after the supply is provided. And also you said that, well, because these cartels are bad, dangerous people, we shouldn't address them as terrorists and take care of them as such. We've encountered a lot of dangerous, bad people over the decades and centuries, especially World War II, et cetera. Just because they're bad and dangerous doesn't mean we should cower and ignore them. That's what seems to be your philosophy. These people, yes, they're dangerous, but they're already committing horrendous crimes. And so we already know that. Yes, they're dangerous. And that's one of the reasons why they need to be taken out.
Okay, Eric. Thanks. Yep. You've made some good points. Let's let Bill address the three points you made.
First of all, I'd like to address them in sequence. So I'll address the first one, where Eric's claim, and we have a gentleman's disagreement. If you go to war against the cartels, they are incestuously and hermetically sealed with the Mexican government. Whether we like that or not, that's what's going to happen. And also what's going to happen is that if we go down there kinetically without declaring war on Mexico, women and children will be maimed and killed in this. And there is no better way to stiffen resistance and steal the spine and make something unpopular than doing that very thing. Also, Eric and I have a disagreement on his second point concerning demand signal. and the supply signal as far as proximate cause or root cause. The root cause there is that you have this demand. The proximate is that you have somebody who is going to service that demand with the signal that's being broadcast far and wide in the U.S. and Europe. And as far as success against terrorist organizations, remember, this is a country that since 2001, if not 1993, when we go back to the first initial bombing, when we look at all of this, we have not had the greatest success in stopping terrorism because there's so many there standing in the ranks. So the warning that I'm issuing with my reservations is this. I think that Eric and I want the same thing, but I want everybody to buckle up and stand by that when you kinetically engage the cartels, there will be tremendous blowback in the United States.
Thanks, Bill. And that was a great call. Good questions, Eric. I guess one of the questions that I would like to ask next, you raised in your podcast, tell us how Russia or Iran, do you think that they could actually start funding proxy organizations in the cartels as an op? You know, we have Iran. They funded all these terror organizations in the Mideast. Do you honestly see that could actually happen on the North American continent?
If you asked me the same question in December, I would have said yes to Russian assistance because of what's been done by NATO, Europe, and the U.S. and some other countries in the Ukraine against the Russian-claimed oblast in the eastern third of the Ukraine, and that's a completely different discussion altogether. Now, where I see there is a rapprochement that is being proffered by this administration to sort of take down the temperature in relations with Russia and China, I think that Russia and China now, this, instead of you asking me this in December, and you're asking me this with the new administration, I sort of doubt if they will supply arms. Because imagine, if this was December, I probably would have said they will provide SAMs, they will provide all kinds of organizational structure, possibly planning and targeting and intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance. Maybe not now, but I'm not taking that off the table. What I won't take off the table is Islamist sleeper cells from whatever Middle Eastern organizations may be out there who wish us ill will, whether they're Shia or Sunni. I did 5 episodes, that's 37, 41 through 43, and 49 through 50, called Storming America, where I talked about what would happen if you upsized and supersized the October 7th, 2023 incursion from Gaza into Israel, and that happened in America one day on a Tuesday morning. What would that look like? And I talked about that there. What terrifies me about this, and I'm hoping I'm completely wrong on this, is since the Mexicans are human traffickers, since they are the ones who bring all of the illegals, could be OTMs, could be sleepers, could be terrorists, they've got them here already. Maybe they have established an organizational linkage with them where they behave or act as proxy auxiliaries to join them in the fight of reprisals against a kinetic hit against Mexico.
Bill, there's just so much I want to talk about. We only have about a minute and a half left, a little over a minute, actually. So I guess the last question I'm going to ask you, do you think the military helping U.S. law enforcement inside the U.S. in terms of tracking shipments or key people, do you think that could be a helpful use of the military without triggering all these second and third order effects that you see as dangerous?
No, because I think that the whether the military is involved or three-letter agencies, or you break down some of the cylinders of excellence that stop certain agencies from sharing intelligence with domestic law enforcement. If you do that, it doesn't mean that you are going to best or be a peer to the intelligence that the cartels currently have in the United States. Now, let's just for argument's sake, we'll call them peers, but I would never say that cartel intelligence networks are lesser than what we have in the United States.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, we're going to have to leave it here. Bill, this is fascinating. Folks, listen to the Chasing Ghosts podcast, an Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare podcast. It's a fascinating discussion, and you know, they keep making this stronger. Now in addition to fentanyl, they say there's something called ISO, which is 20 to 100 times stronger than fentanyl. So we got our work cut out for us to stomp down that demand curve.
Thanks for having me.
Bill, great job. Good job on the podcast, and we'll talk to you again sometime.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice. We'll be right back after the news and couple of messages. It is me. It's Matt Neely on 1030 The Voice. And you're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm sitting in for Ted Maxwell. The Morning Voice is a new show with we have a different host for each day of the week. Mondays, we have Lydia Aranda, and she does Morning Rainmakers. Tuesdays, Ted Maxwell, he does Civic Engagement. And Wednesday, Grant Kruger, that's tomorrow, and he does food, restaurant news and updates, and where the law intersects with restaurant business. And tomorrow, who will have on Josh Jacobson? And I think they're going to be talking about whatever of the Proposition 414 results are available to discuss. At least Thursday's Tom Moulton talking about tourism and a very important cog in the Tucson economic wheel. And Friday, Ed Ackerley with Ackerley Advertising. He'll be talking with us about business success stories and University of Arizona wonder stories, and a lot of great stuff going on at the University of Arizona. Greg, if you're nearby, that was a fascinating subject about the Mexican drug cartels and some of the policy ideas that President Trump and his administration have put forth.
Well, I didn't want to jump in because you had a lot. We could have gone on for an hour with Bill.
That was a longer interview, you bet.
But you and I were talking yesterday, and Bill Buckmaster was sitting in there with us in the office, and I was just talking about, you know, wondering, part of me really believes that Sheinbaum wants to do something about this.
So it's to your point, it's interesting. I may have closed the article down, but you sent me an article from the New York Times over the weekend, and it did say that by signaling this, Trump has gotten help from the Mexican authorities. The new president, Sheinbaum, has made more fentanyl seizures in the last 5 months than they did the year before.
Well, there's been that belief. It's almost as if previous administrations wanted to say, there's just nothing we can really do about it. You know, look at what happened when Calderon declared war on the cartels, and it just created violence everywhere, and the number of deaths went up and the number of disappeared. But it's clear they're capable of doing something. Now, Sheinbaum's predecessor, AMLO, didn't. He wanted, you know, basically, let's try to do peace and all this stuff. He did not want to militarize this fight. And even though AMLO is really responsible for Sheinbaum, because they're both part of the Morena party, she's basically taking a different tack. And I think that kind of partnering up with Trump and doing what he asks is sort of an excuse. If you see what I'm trying to get at there, I'm suggesting that she's using the pressure Trump has put on Mexico as an excuse to do something that I believe deep down inside she wants to do.
Yeah.
She was a city councilwoman in Mexico City prior to being Mexico City's mayor. And Mexico City, by and large, has not had the problems with violence that many other large cities in Mexico have had. So I wouldn't necessarily call her a law and order president, but I think she's dramatically different than AMLO.
Well, and I think, you know, what Bill Buper was speaking about, we do need to stamp down the demand curve, but I always look at things, can we do this as a partnership? Can you guys do your best, give your best effort to stomp down the labs that are there? Because as I said, going out, I mean, it's a losing battle, and you and I have talked about this a lot. The whole opioid thing, in part, was, you know, it used to be heroin was the strong drug the strong street drug that people used, and it generally was only used by I hate to use the word recreational drug users, but it was generally only used by people that were just kind of looking for their kicks or whatever, looking for the next high.
Exactly.
But we had the opioid crisis fueled by, you know, things like Vicodin and OxyContin and all this stuff.
Primarily, it was OxyContin. I mean, let's put it out there right now. What really got this going, and you can go on to Max. There's a documentary called "The Crime of the Century" about what happened with the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma in the '90s. People they bribed to push the drug through clinical trials. It was like, we need the next great pain drug,
and they would tell people. The selling point, the calling card was, this is not addictive. Spoiler alert, it was highly addictive.
It was as highly addictive as ever any drug ever sold in the United States.
So then you see the drug use, especially among the synthetic opioids, grow from just those people, you know, whatever, looking for kicks, to people. The U.S. government said, okay, everybody, you need to stomp down, or we need to reduce the...
And they did.
...the prescription of
I could tell you this. One of the hardest hit areas in the entire United States was the state where I went to college. Yeah. That's West Virginia. Huntington, West Virginia, about 8 years ago, was considered the overdose capital of the United States. Now, this is per capita, but in a city of 50,000, one August afternoon, they had 52 overdoses.
Yeah.
And so part of that is because that is a part of the country that they got the drug into first.
Yep.
Okay?
Yeah.
So what happened was they got that drug off the streets, and immediately the cartels, including drugs coming in from Canada, a lot of this stuff came down from Detroit into the Huntington, West Virginia area, and fentanyl was huge. You know,
so now you see a big shift in the users of these synthetic opioids to people that maybe had chronic pain and their doctor said, hey, we need to wean you off of this.
Yeah.
And so you saw a big shift in that. And then it is totally not a fair fight, because you have OxyContin, which is very strong, and then it's fentanyl, and then they start putting this thing called Trank, which is just bad news. And now, like I said, in the last couple of weeks, I've seen a couple of these stories about this something called ISO. The nickname of it is ISO.
And I think that's multiple
times stronger than fentanyl.
We see the result of the fentanyl crisis in Tucson day in and day out. I mean, we have a new homeless encampment on the southwestern edge of our complex here that we're living in. But I really feel as if, again, thousands and thousands of teenagers have died. But the incident that occurred here with the young lady about a month ago just really hit home. You're familiar with the story I'm talking about.
Help me out.
It was the 14-year-old girl.
Oh, yeah.
That died in her bed.
Yeah.
No indication from her parents that she'd had previous problems with drugs. Somebody gave her a pill, and it obviously was fentanyl. You know, and way too potent for her little body.
Yeah, their quality control is not really good in those fentanyl labs. So I remember seeing that the dose size is like 2 grains or something, or it's not grams, but it's like it's 2 micrograms or something. And it's like, but the pills contain anywhere between 1 and 3. And so the quote unquote dose is 2. But, you know, again, they don't invest a lot of money in stirring up the battery.
And the people that sell the drugs absolutely do not care.
Right.
Obviously, the cartels that get them into the country do not care. And it's clear that the Chinese that are shipping the chemicals to make the fentanyl into Mexican ports obviously don't care. And even if going all the way to the top, the CCP over there would be more than happy, because it's just something else to destabilize an economic rival.
Well, Greg, and this is the one, we just ran out of time, but the one question I wanted to get to was, when does the United States have to deal with, or when are we going to deal with a dirty bomb? But instead of using radioactive material that they'll blow up, they'll use fentanyl, or they'll put fentanyl into a water supply, or God forbid, a food supply. And the power of that, the potential to kill so many people, it just frightens me. So I mean, I think we've been lucky so far, and I hope that continues, but
to some people in this town, you're going to sound like some kind of crazy far-right QAnon extremist if you make those suggestions, but there's absolutely a tremendous amount of validity in what you're saying.
What did we say? The crazy conspiracy theorists are crazy conspiracy theorists until it comes to pass. It's just terrible. Anyway, thanks for jumping in with me there, Greg. We're going to take a break a little early. You're listening to The Morning Voice. You got Matt Neely, Greg Gehringer behind the glass, a little switcheroo today, sitting in for Ted Maxwell. We're going to go to break a little early. We will be right back in just a couple of minutes. Hey, it's Matt Neely. We're back on The Morning Voice, and we're going to go to our friend Steve Levine over at... Why are we getting... Hey, Stephen, can you mute your computer, maybe?
Yeah.
There we go. Okay. If you're still putting off your estate plan, stay with us for this next segment, because... I tell you what, Stephen, can I just have you call in on the phone? I don't know what's going on here, but... can you mute?
Sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Sounds.
All right. We will be right back. Stephen will be right back with us. Again, I just want to thank Bill Buppert, host of the Chasing Ghosts podcast. And I'd like to thank Frank Antonori, Cochise County Supervisor, for sitting in with us today and talking about what's going on in Cochise County. Also, we talked to Angel Charity for Children about their upcoming spring event. And we've got Stephen Levine back. So let's go. All right. If you're still putting off your estate plan, stay with us for this next segment because you need to know the consequences for you and your family if you don't have one. Stephen from RJP Estate Planning is here to break it all down. Stephen, in my experience, a lot of people know they should have an estate plan, but they put it off. Why is it important to take action now?
Hey, good morning, Matt. Yeah, so, you know, I tell people all the time, every person needs an estate plan, not just the uber wealthy. So the idea of estate planning that it's only for the rich and wealthy is one of the biggest misconceptions out there. The truth is, not having a plan could cause serious problems, including unnecessary legal costs, stress, and most importantly, family conflict. So imagine going to bed every night not knowing if the people you love, care about, would be protected if something happened to you. So an estate plan gives you the peace of mind because it protects you while you're alive and also makes sure that the loved ones are taken care of when you're gone.
Most people think about estate planning in terms of what happens after they pass away. Why is it just as critical while you're alive?
You know, life's not static. It's unpredictable. None of us plan to get into an accident, face a sudden illness, but those things happen. If something causes you to become incapacitated, for example, and you don't have an estate plan in place, your family could face serious obstacles. Here's a few things that could happen, you know, for example. Number one, no one is legally authorized to manage your finances if you don't have an estate plan or make medical decisions on your behalf. That means your family would have to go to court, have a guardian appointed by the court to oversee your medical care, and have another person known as a conservator to manage your assets. A judge, not you or the family, could decide who controls your money and your personal affairs. This legal process could take months, cost thousands of dollars in legal fees, even lead to family disputes. So if your children can't agree on who should be in charge, the court would appoint maybe a complete stranger to make those important decisions for you. And none of those decisions may really be aligned with what your wishes would have been or are. So without a medical power of attorney, hospitals could delay your treatment while waiting for the court's approval on who will oversee those medical cares. And it might not be who you want. So your finances also face the similar risk. Without having a living trust or a financial power of attorney, your loved ones may not even be able to access your bank accounts to pay your bills. This includes your mortgage. That could lead to possible foreclosures on your home. And without having these documents, your situation could turn into an unnecessary crisis for your family.
So having power of attorney documents and a living trust offers you protections while you're alive. But if you pass away without having key documents you need, is it too late to fix anything? What happens then?
Yeah, so that's where things get even harder for your family. So first, obviously, your family's grieving. They don't want to have to mess with going through a court system or a probate. Then, in the middle of all this, they're thrown into a complicated legal process called probate court, which in Arizona is required in almost all cases if you own a house or if you have over $75,000 in personal assets. That means if you meet either of these low thresholds, probate is required even if you have a will. And what happens in probate court could be multiple things. So that means your family has to locate and document everything you own. Probate's public. That means your bank accounts, your home deed, any other property deeds that you own, your investments, vehicles, personal assets. During this lengthy process, The court could freeze your assets until all of your debts are paid. This includes your taxes, your medical bills, credit cards, home mortgage, if you have one. Your bank accounts ultimately could be locked and frozen by the bank. That forces somebody in your family to either have to pay these expenses out of their own pocket or wait for the court's approval to sell some of your assets in order to free up some of the money to pay your expenses. This probate process could take months, even years, cost tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees, all of which comes directly out of the family inheritance.
If more people knew this, they'd be racing to get an estate plan today. So once the court eventually settles everything, did the kids finally get their inheritance?
Yeah, I mean, eventually, but what's left? So after court, legal fees, all the other expenses, the inheritance could be a lot smaller. If you have more than one child, or a lot of times we see blended families where there's stepchildren mixed with your own, you know, bloodline, your own biological children, that's where I see a lot of real conflict when there's argument and there's kind of that family torn dynamic. A lot of kids are saying, well, you know, my dad and your mom and my dad's assets should be mine. Your mom's are yours. The number one thing children argue about when it comes to inheritance is who gets what. Even if you have a will, family disputes happen because a will must go through probate court, and that's public record. So that means creditors, estranged relatives, other interested parties can all kind of come out of the woodwork and contest your will. That's why having a living trust is the most reliable estate planning document, not only to protect your finances while you're alive and incapacitated, but also to pass your assets to who you want them to go to. So unlike a will, a trust keeps your estate private. It avoids probate. It makes it much more difficult to contest. This ensures that your assets go directly to your loved ones without any court interference.
It's a wake-up call for anyone without an estate plan or just a will. Stephen, what can our listeners do now to protect themselves and their families?
Yeah, Matt, so they can call us at RJP Estate Planning, that's 520-441-4523, to schedule a free consultation. We'll sit down, we'll see if, you know, if you need a trust, what documents do we need to put together. We'll answer your questions, share a plan with how RJP Estate Planning can protect your assets and your family's future. RJP's Living Trust Package includes everything you need, which financial, medical power of attorneys, a trust, a pour-over will to catch any assets that you might have missed or forgot to put into your trust. Once you become incapacitated, you know, those documents help assign who your medical financial agents are. Once you're a client of RJP, we offer free settlement support to guide your family through the inheritance process when that time comes. You know, I kind of call it the hand-holding process. It's a really small investment relative to get this package. It's a fraction of the cost of what your loved ones could potentially pay in probate court settlement later down the road. So for the past three decades, RJP Estate Planning's helped more than 40,000 families here in Arizona. And if you're at least 60 years old, you know, we run these specials, a living trust package, get 65% off if you're 60 years or older and a discount on a living trust package, and receive all the other documents that I mentioned earlier at no additional cost. Make sure you schedule that free consultation to get on the next round of appointments by this Thursday, March 13th, before 4 p.m. That's when we're cutting it off. So call us at 520-441-4523 now to get started.
Don't wait. Protect your legacy today. Call RJP Estate Planning at 520-441-4523. That's 520-441-4523. Thanks for joining us again today, Stephen.
Yeah, Matt, thanks for having me.
Have a wonderful day, sir.
You too. Enjoy the weather.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Well, roller coaster, rain, yeah, wind, rain, wind, heat. Repeat. Have a good one.
I know. It's you too. Take care.
Thank you. Well, Greg, I think we've gotten through it. There's a couple things sticking in my craw that I think I want to get off my chest.
Okay, please.
It's been a while. An airing of grievances.
Okay.
So first of all, I saw, you know, there's this carjacking situation last week on Friday, I think it was. And this guy was getting out of his car at a hotel over, I think it was at the hotel at but he was at Broadway in Alvernon. He's getting out of his car, getting into his car, and somebody comes up, assaults him with a gun, with a rifle, I believe it was.
Yeah.
You know, they take the car, they go for a joyride or whatever they were going to use the car for, injured the guy, thankfully, a non-fatal injury. And they wrecked it into a wall near 22nd in Columbus, just north of there at Eastland. Well, they caught one of the guys. He's a 16-year-old. And so he goes on a video conference with the judge. And it was, since it's on video conference, it's captured for posterity. It was posted online. And the judge was saying that the 16-year-old boy had been through a lot. He aggravated armed robbery, okay, where he actually injured the victim. And she said, well, the 16-year-old kid has been through a lot.
He's been through a lot. This is restorative justice is what this is.
What is going on?
It's restorative justice.
I just can't get over this. And so they talked about him. You know, his public defender said, well, you know, he's a full-time student. Well, yeah, he's 16 years old. He should have been in school, not out carjacking.
He's a full-time screw-up is what he is.
What he is. And so the judge says, well, I don't want to put a 16-year-old in jail. Well, I don't know what.
Well, where do you want to put him?
Your house?
You want to put him up at the Double Tree?
Just like, what is going on
here?
Here's
an Xbox.
This is like the theater of the absurd we have in Tucson. Every day, every week.
It's not their fault. Yeah, they had a hard go of it.
Yeah, hard go of it.
Yeah, and how many other people have had a hard go of it and gotten their crap together?
Yeah, it's right. It's true. It just infuriated me when I saw that. And the judge did say that the kid had cooperated and given up names, so that probably wouldn't make his stay in jail very enjoyable. But, you know, that's why they, and again, when you have these situations, they hand the gun off to the kid because they know as a minor, he's going to have a better go of it in the court system. That's why they have the adults to have the kids do all the shooting.
And my thought is this. So I was actually driving down Swan that day when I saw the TPD kind of parked along the side of the road in case they came in that direction.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thought that went through my head is these little punks, and that's exactly what they are little, you know, I'll say it, little badasses in their neighborhoods. You know, maybe their brother ran with a gang, and they want to show how tough they are until they get caught.
It's unreal.
And then suddenly it's like, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
So to the judge who said, you know, I don't want to put a person in jail that committed armed robbery and aggravated assault on somebody, I don't know what to say. Find another job. Thanks for listening to The Morning Voice today. Ted will be back next week. And coming up next, it's Win Tucson with Kathleen Wynn right here on 1030 The Voice.